I'm Lester Holt. Tonight on Dateline, a mother who will stop at nothing to find her son's killer.
I remember telling him, I'm so sorry, mommy wasn't there for you. I cannot rest until I find out who did this and why. Who shot him?
Was he shot while he was in the car?
In the car.
Who lives there? Well, like, why would he be there?
The only trouble that he would ever get in would be with women.
He was texting, making phone calls, all at the same time.
You finally see that video from the police camera.
I can't get that image out my head.
Our son is on the ground, dying.
My family immediately went into action.
She found out a lot of things on her own that police didn't tell her.
Yes, she needed to keep investigating.
I knew that I had to do the work myself.
Y'all only have a 26% murder solve rate.
Yeah, you know, it's the community that's failing here.
My son deserves justice. I will keep fighting for him until my last breath.
Here's Josh Mankiewicz with The Story of Somebody.
Sometimes it's a sound that brings it all back. The thump of a basketball on a rim or backboard. That's when Shapurl Wells can almost see them again. Her son and his friends, playing ball late into the night. His name was Courtney, but on the court he was hard work 34, a left-hander who could shoot with either hand. Her son who bounced through life, dancing with the dog and his sisters.
Little Jazzy.
Singing in his car. His joy made anything seem possible. Sometimes those memories help his mom, Shapurl, forget the horror of what came next and the person she had to become.
Do you have any experience being an investigator?
No, not at all. I'm a mom on a mission. The last thing that his mom can do is go and find out who did this to him.
Shapurl's long battle to solve the mystery of what happened to her son forced her to confront questions that went beyond Courtney. Questions about who gets justice in Chicago, in this life, in this country, and who does not.
It was almost like a willfulness to not know what happened to Courtney.
If you want to get away with murder in America, kill a black person? Before we answer that, let's go back to a March night in 2016. It was cold, the way only Chicago can be. Shapurl was asleep in her bed in suburban Cicero.
Around 2 a.m., I hear this thunderous beat at my door.
Police shone their flashlights through the windows, and what followed was terrifying news. Her 22-year-old son, Courtney, was in the hospital, but she says they didn't tell her why.
I remember falling to the floor because...
Because if he's in there with a broken leg, they're going to tell you that.
Yes. So I knew that this must be bad.
Her first thought was an accident. Courtney was well known for texting, dancing, Snapchatting, while behind the wheel of his beloved BMW. At the hospital, the family was taken not to see Courtney, but to a room with chairs and Kleenex. Clarissa Hawkins was one of the nurses.
I just remember Shapurl just like kind of like immediately started shaking.
Finally, the doctor came in.
And so he said that my son had arrived with a gunshot wound.
Shot in the back. They'd done all they could, but Courtney was dead.
I remember grabbing her and holding her hand and hugging her.
And I remember us all proclaiming, who shot him? Because that was the furthest thing from my mind, that my son was shot and killed.
Of course, in the parts of Chicago that appear more often in police reports than in tourism ads, leading a peaceful life doesn't immunize you against death at the hands of another.
Did you ever worry about him getting caught up in the violence that seems to be raging in Chicago in recent years?
I would say I worried when he was in high school. Like, you know, once he graduated from high school, I was like, whew, he made it. He's safe.
That night at the hospital, Shapiro says police gave her only the basics. Courtney had been found across town in a neighborhood Shapiro hardly knew. And she says they had a question for her.
Who was the owner of the BMW? And I said, my son.
Seemed like an odd thing to ask, but Shapiro had more pressing questions, like why Courtney had even been in that neighborhood. Friends gathered at the hospital, including Courtney's best friend, Chris Pineda. He told Shapiro and the police he'd seen Courtney just a few hours earlier in Cicero, in the parking lot next to their local pizza joint.
And he was like, man, you know, I just started reading this new book. I'm writing all the things that, you know, I want to accomplish in my life. He was just so happy.
Chris says Courtney was headed home. So how had he ended up in Northwest Chicago?
You know, I started asking, who lives there? Who do we know that lives there? Who, like, why would he be there?
Finally, someone at the hospital put two and two together. That neighborhood was where Alma lived.
And I remember his cousin saying, who's Alma? Who's Alma? Where is she? And she walking in, she's like, that's me. Like, what's going on?
That's how Shapiro learned Courtney had a secret girlfriend. Shapiro wanted to talk with her, hoping to learn something, anything, about Courtney's last moments. How he'd come to rest in that hospital, where Shapiro had just said goodbye.
Seeing him had to be the hardest thing you've ever gone through.
It was. I remember telling him, I'm so sorry mommy wasn't there for you. I could imagine how you felt so scared. I don't know what happened to you.
In that instant, Shapiro made a promise to herself and her son. She would do everything she could to find out what did happen. And nothing was going to stop her.
When we come back, what would Shapiro learn about that awful night?
First of all, you have our condolences.
Thank you.
A meeting and a recording.
Was he shot while he was in the car?
In the car.
Who was the officer on the scene?
The questions for police were just beginning as we continue with The Story of Somebody, part of NBC News' week-long look at policing in America.
Shapiro Wells had finally stopped crying. In place of tears came something else.
There are a lot of uneasy questions and unanswered questions that are rolling through my mind.
In her fog of grief, Shapiro decided to start making audio recordings of her journey. Maybe a way to make sense of it all.
First of all, you have our condolences.
Thank you.
And so Shapiro was recording when she and her husband Brent met with Chicago police detectives a few days after Courtney's murder.
We're going to do everything we can and follow the evidence where it takes us to bring the person that did this or persons to justice.
The audio captures police interacting with a murder victim's family in the early days of an investigation.
Everybody we've spoken to, your son was a great kid, and nobody's had a bad word to say about him.
That was no surprise to Shapiro. Courtney was a mama's boy.
My mom just came back from Wisconsin. She bought me this hat. Say Gucci. Gucci boy.
And he was close to Brent, his stepdad. They bonded over wrestling and jokes from the time he was little.
He said, like, what do you call stolen cheese? I said, I don't know. What do you call it? He said, nacho cheese. I'm like, oh.
My stepdad told me, cut the grass.
This is my little twin.
And he was fiercely protective of his younger sisters. After a semester away at college on an athletic scholarship, Courtney was home again, working and hanging out with friends. Courtney had a lot of those.
He had the ability to make everyone feel like he was their best friend.
That's also a pretty good skill to have in business.
It is.
Courtney was in business with Jova Mendoza and Jessica Soto, selling memberships to a travel club called World Ventures. and Courtney hustled as hard as he had on the basketball court, determined to earn enough so his mom could stop working.
He'll tell you, if my mom is still working, I gotta work triple, 10 times harder.
It was so normal for me to wake up, you know, to a message from him at 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning, you know.
And Courtney's hard work was paying off. That flashy BMW he drove was a bonus from World Ventures.
Welcome easy to the...
He picked it out himself.
Who gets a convertible in Chicago?
Courtney. He does. Baby, that's what he called her.
He named his car.
Yes. He'd be like, oh, I love you, baby.
Now, Bebe was in police custody. Courtney's beloved car was potential evidence in his murder. And Chaperl sat across a table from CPD detectives.
Okay, and based on the evidence that you have now, was he shot while he was in the car?
In the car.
Exactly where that had happened wasn't clear. Somehow Courtney, seriously wounded, had driven himself to a police station, where he asked an officer stopped at a traffic light for help.
Who was the officer on the scene that assisted my son?
There were several officers on the scene, mm-hmm. and they're comforting to your son. We know that for a fact.
The detective said they'd already spent time knocking on doors, looking for witnesses. So far, without much luck.
We have a lack of witnesses.
Sure.
And that's any case, your son's case, any case, you want witnesses. You need people to tell you things that happened.
And Chaperl thought she could help. She told detectives someone had contacted her on Facebook. That tipster said on the same night Courtney was shot, he'd seen three men driving around the area in a Grand Marquis. Later, he'd seen them tossing a handgun under a truck.
It's already been addressed. And that's actually almost an hour afterwards.
So this was a separate incident?
Separate incident, correct.
Detectives did say they wouldn't rule anything out and told Chaperl how they planned to work it.
The way we work is we work from in to out. Mm-hmm. Closest to out, where Courtney was at, what he was doing, who he was seeing.
And surely, no one was closer to Courtney that night than Alma, his secret girlfriend. Alma said Courtney texted her he was outside her apartment that night, and then never showed up. Chaperl wanted to be sure detectives spoke with her.
I didn't know Alma. I don't know if she had crazy boyfriends or what have you.
The sergeant reassured Chaperl.
Normally, throughout these courses of these investigations, we speak with people numerous times.
Before she left, Courtney's mom begged the cops to take this one personally.
Fight this case as if it was your own child.
Absolutely.
Do whatever. Please do.
Chaperl wasn't one to sit around and wait. While detectives worked, she requested Courtney's medical records from the hospital, desperate to know all she could about his last moments. Brent drove her to pick them up, and what she read changed everything.
By the time I make it back to the car, I'm like in tears, and I'm like, they did something to him, Brent. They did something to him.
Coming up, video from the night of the shooting. What did Chaperl see in her son's final moments?
We were able to see for our own eyes that what they said about him was a lie.
When Dateline continues.
Chaperl needed some place to think. She'd just picked up her murdered son's medical records from the hospital, only to spot something she absolutely did not understand.
He was handcuffed. That's what the paperwork states.
Handcuffed? Chaperl's husband took her to a restaurant to sit down and look over the paperwork.
When I walk in the door, lo and behold, it's the nurse.
The same one who'd comforted you at the hospital.
Yes, the same one who had comforted me at the hospital. And I said, I have to ask you a question. Was my son handcuffed?
They had him handcuffed to the bed.
Nurse Clarissa Hawkins remembers the handcuffs vividly.
She says the medical team couldn't immediately transfer Courtney to a hospital bed because he had one arm cuffed to the gurney.
So we were like, okay, where's the police? We need these handcuffs off. So maybe about a minute or two went by and, you know, the police rushed in and they unhandcuffed him.
Why would a shooting victim be handcuffed?
I would say in my years of practice, I have never seen a gunshot victim handcuffed. So in my opinion, he was treated more like a suspect rather than a patient.
That's what Shapiro thought too, especially when she remembered police asking her at the hospital if Courtney owned the BMW he was driving. Courtney was the owner, she told police, although his name wasn't on the car's registration. He had bad credit, so he asked his friend to sign the papers.
Sounds to me like police are asking about the car because they're wondering whether he stole the car, right?
Yes. You know, I could understand if they ran his plates, but none of this mattered. I felt that the concern should not be with the car. It should be about saving his life.
The official explanation for the police handcuffs can be found in the paramedics report. Courtney had been violent, agitated, a danger to others. But why would that be? There were no drugs in his system. A police review later said traumatic shock made him combative. A spokesman for the paramedics told us Courtney was handcuffed for medical reasons, and he was not in custody.
They're claiming that people who are experiencing trauma sometimes fight because they're so frantic.
Handcuffing is not something that is normal, even if the person is violent and agitated or flailing.
We checked that with several experts who train paramedics. They told us that while gunshot victims do sometimes need to be restrained for their own safety, it's unusual for any patient to arrive at an ER in handcuffs unless they're in police custody.
If it was a white child, would he have been treated the same way?
To Shapiro, it seemed police had racially profiled her son from the start, which led her to another place. What if the police Courtney had gone to for help had been the ones who killed him?
I immediately thought that this was maybe a traffic stop gone wrong and that they're hiding something.
That instant suspicion speaks volumes about both the state of policing in America and the relationship between the Chicago cops and the communities they police.
Safe to say you were already, to some degree, mistrustful of Chicago police before your son was ever shot.
Yes.
A few months before Courtney's murder, Chicago was engulfed in protests following the release of video showing the police shooting of a teenager named Laquan McDonald.
Dramatic dashcam video showing Officer Van Dyke shooting McDonald 16 times.
The officer who shot him was later convicted of second-degree murder. All of that made Shapiro wonder if there was video of her son's encounter with police. She'd counted at least 10 police and private cameras in the neighborhood where Courtney had been shot. What had they recorded? Police would not let her see the footage.
And so that heightened my suspicion again.
She filed public records requests, organized rallies, and enlisted the help of a nonprofit journalism foundation called the Invisible Institute. 500 days after Courtney's murder, Shapiro was allowed to view the video police had found of her son's final night. She quickly realized she'd been wrong. Courtney wasn't shot by police.
You came to believe the police were not involved in shooting him.
Yes. The evidence did not point to them being involved.
There was Courtney's car zooming down the street. A minute later, another camera captured it stopped next to a squad car. Courtney's voice on a 911 call.
Chicago,
the police officer immediately called for help.
Send an ambulance right away.
And suddenly something else was clear to Shapiro, something that made her angry all over again. Nowhere on the available video did she see Courtney being violent, agitated,
or a danger to others, as is written in the paramedic's report. What she did see was her son talking to police, answering their questions.
Victim is a male. His name is Courtney Copeland. Give me a date of birth.
We were able to see for our own eyes that what they said about him was a lie.
And this moment on the video haunts Shapiro. Her son raising his arm to the cops who she says treated Courtney with suspicion rather than compassion.
Could you imagine looking at a video and your son is reaching up, begging them to help him? At that moment, I can imagine Courtney feeling the life leaving his body.
More than a year after Courtney's murder, his mother did not trust Chicago police to solve it. She decided she would do that herself. Shapiro Wells was just getting started.
Coming up, evidence. Shapiro hunts down more.
A woman reported that she heard gunshots.
Is the puzzle coming together?
One year after a murder, you'd expect detectives to know a whole lot about their victim. So how well did Chicago police detectives know Courtney Copeland?
You two were among his closest friends. So, I mean, if I were investigating his death, I'd be talking to the two of you. What was going on in his life? Who was he seeing? Who didn't like him? Did police ask you those questions?
No. I was never interviewed by any type of detective.
Jova, they sit you down and ask any of that stuff?
Mm-mm. It's surprising, because they should have, you know.
Shapiro had obtained some copies of the detective's case reports. In spite of their reassuring words about working the case in to out, it looked as if they had never set up interviews with any of Courtney's friends.
You understand that in this country, there is almost no family of any homicide victim who believes that the police are doing enough. Everybody wants to see more of an effort.
But I don't think that a lot of families have access to the evidence that I had.
After months investigating her son's case, getting her hands on those reports, recording her interactions with police, and walking the neighborhood, Shapiro Wells had teamed up with Allison Flowers, the director of investigations at the Invisible Institute. Allison shared her work with us.
So one thing that I did was I went through all his past calls, all his recent text messages, and tried to just understand in the days leading up to his death what he was up to and if there was any trouble going on in his life.
Allison did some investigative work that did not seem to be duplicated in the police case file. She went through Courtney's phone and built a timeline of his last day. He'd chatted with his grandma and gone to a work event. Later, after that meeting with Chris, he'd gone home, posting a Snapchat outside his house.
I just gotta believe in myself.
And then he turned around and headed off to see Alma.
He's texting Alma that he's outside, simultaneously talking to another girl on the phone, we think. And then he's Facebook messaging his friend Brandon, who had just gotten a new job.
90 seconds later, his BMW is racing toward the police station less than a mile away. So where exactly did the shooting happen?
I mean, it's the most basic of facts to know where Courtney was shot.
We've got broken glass at Belden and Long.
Allison tracked down police dispatch tapes and heard how an officer had found broken glass after the shooting around the corner from Alma's apartment. Maybe glass from Courtney's car window. Allison knew from an old parking ticket the spot was close to where Courtney parked when he went to visit Alma.
There was also a woman who lived on the corner at the time who spoke to one of Courtney's friends, and she reported that she heard gunshots. So we do have several data points telling us where this likely occurred.
A few hundred feet from Alma's apartment,
So who would have wanted him dead?
Could Courtney possibly have been involved in something illegal?
No.
He was scared. He'll be... No, he was too scared for that. The only trouble that he would ever get in would be with women. That's it.
Women were his weak spot.
Yes.
So he was going through Chicago like the fire.
I would say more than Chicago. He was, yeah.
It was like kind of international.
Chicago was just his headquarters.
Yeah.
Because Courtney and Alma worked together, they kept their romance under wraps. Jessica knew about it and worried. Alma had confided in her that her ex-boyfriend was possessive and jealous. And on Courtney's phone, Allison read something about another of Alma's exes.
She had indicated to him that a few days prior, one of her exes had left jail or prison in a different state, and that was of some concern to her.
Hadn't Shapiro asked detectives about whether Alma had a crazy ex-boyfriend? Yes, she had. There was a handwritten note in the police documents about one of Alma's boyfriends who didn't like Courtney. However, there was no sign anyone had followed up on that. So Allison decided she would. It was time to talk with Alma.
Coming up.
When you heard the shots, did you think, that could be Courtney?
It didn't cross my mind.
A new clue from Alma. Had she shared it with police?
They said that they were going to call me, and after that, I never heard from them.
I didn't understand. I mean, this is normal detective work.
When Dateline continues.
If you've watched a lot of Dateline, you know detectives usually talk extensively with the victim's partner or significant other, probably more than once. Police had briefly spoken with Alma, Courtney's girlfriend, the night of the shooting. After that, there was no indication in case reports that detectives had gone back to Alma, and it didn't look as if they'd followed up on a tip about her jealous ex.
I didn't understand why they didn't do a thorough examination of Alma. I mean, this is normal detective work.
So Shapiro and Allison went to interview her, recording that conversation.
You're Alma?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Allison.
Alma repeated what she'd told police. Courtney had texted her he was outside, but she never saw him. She'd texted back to see if he was okay, and then, without an answer, she'd gone to sleep.
What did you think happened at that point in time?
I mean, I was a little bit worried, but it's not unlike him to change plans quickly.
Alma said police had never asked her if she'd seen or heard anything that night.
They just gave me their business card, and they said that they were going to call me to speak with me. And after that, I never heard from them.
They never questioned her about her ex-boyfriends, so Allison did. Alma told her, yes, she had an ex who didn't like Courtney, but he was no murderer.
You didn't feel like he could be involved in this in some way?
No.
And if police had interviewed Alma, she might have told them she'd heard two gunshots that night.
When you heard the shots, did you think, that could be Courtney? Or did it not even cross your mind?
It didn't cross my mind because around that time, there was just a lot of things going on in the neighborhood. So we had heard gunshots before.
Allison tracked down another witness who'd heard gunshots around the same time. And she showed us that location was just a few blocks from Alma's apartment.
She was parking by the high school.
The woman named Elena also saw a car speeding down an alley and thought it might be connected. She called 911.
Right now through the alley, there was like two gangsters.
Okay, I'll send someone over to check it out.
A month later, detectives investigating Courtney's case went to interview Elena. She told them her husband Edgar had also seen the car and its passengers.
But police didn't interview him, even though she told detectives that he had been right there in the alley when the car was passing through.
And he had seen these guys.
He had seen the guys. In fact, he had the best look at the guys because the window was down. The alley is extremely narrow. So he had a front row seat to who was in that car.
And here is where some of the puzzle pieces seem to start coming together.
The make of the car Edgar saw? A Grand Marquis, the same type of car that Facebook tipster told Chaparral about. The plates both men saw even seemed to match. And this, Allison spotted what looks like a Grand Marquis in some of the video. Here it is, around the time of the shooting, near the intersection where Courtney was killed. Remember, the tipster said he'd seen the man in the car ditching a handgun, and he'd called 911.
It appeared that they threw a gun under the car.
In response to that call, police arrested two guys that night. They were known gang members and charged with parole violations. But there's nothing to suggest detectives investigated them in connection with Courtney's murder.
It's almost like a willfulness to not know.
I saw a story last night that said the 37 people were shot this weekend in Chicago and five of them were killed. Should we be surprised that police don't do all hands on deck for every single murder? Because they seem like, these guys seem like maybe they were kind of numb to it.
Perhaps they were numb to it, but it also, you know, begs the question, what are they here for? They're not preventing crimes, and they're not solving them either.
It all pointed to a troubling hypothesis.
There's an institutional indifference to solving cases when it comes to people of color.
This man says the numbers tell a story.
Coming up.
So the best way to get away with murder in America is to kill a black victim?
Your odds are better than if you kill a victim of any other race.
Chaparral challenges the police.
Y'all only have a 26% murder solve rate.
Yeah, you know, it's the community that's failing here.
Exactly 2 years after his murder, a mother deliberately drove the roads her son had taken the last night of his life.
I wanted to see what my son was seeing, his point of view, what he was thinking.
Just after 1:15 a.m., Chaparral Wells pulled her son's BMW to a stop on the same asphalt where he had flagged down police.
You feel better when it was over?
No, I didn't feel better. But I was like, Courtney, mommy is here. Mommy's here. You're not alone.
And Chaparral knew she wasn't alone either. In 2016, the year Courtney was killed, there were 778 murders in Chicago. That same year, police solved, or in their words, cleared, 56% of murders involving white victims. For black murder victims, the solve rate was just 26%. Thomas Hargrove is the founder of the Murder Accountability Project, a nonprofit that has collected and analyzed four decades of homicide reports nationwide. His data is used by numerous police departments around the country. He says racial disparity when it comes to solving murders is not just a Chicago problem.
In 2019, the most recent year for which we have data, Caucasian murders were cleared at a rate of 81%. That's the best it's ever been for white murders. But for African Americans, it's been in the 50s lately.
Hargrove says that's true all over the country, in cities big and small, communities urban or rural. Solve rates for black murder victims are lower than for any other racial group, and they're continuing to drop.
So the best way to get away with murder in America is to kill a black victim?
If you generally kill a black victim, your odds are better than if you kill a victim of any other race. That is simply what the data show.
Too simple to say the answer is that departments across the country are prioritizing murders in which the victim's white?
I would not believe that. I really wouldn't. I don't think it's a general racism among detectives, but I do think that there are factors that take solvability out of their hands.
Statistically, murders involving black victims are more likely to be committed by strangers or by gangs. Those cases are harder to solve. Hargrove says overloaded homicide detectives need more manpower and training. That takes more money. And if race plays a role, it's in how and where police dollars get spent.
Unfortunately, in a great many places, insufficient resources are being applied because of the political decision on how much effort shall be made in these kinds of crimes.
Without those resources, Hargrove says, murders will go unsolved, and the result is a devastating spiral. If the cops aren't solving murders, potential witnesses don't feel safe enough to speak up, and killings continue.
Murder begets murder, especially unsolved murder.
You had tremendous success closing homicides at a rate, I think, better than the national average. What's the secret?
One thing I truly believe that helped in our success is that we had relationships in communities in which we work.
Dr. Cedric Alexander was chief of police in DeKalb County, Georgia, and is now a law enforcement analyst for NBC News. He says solving murders has to involve cooperation between police and citizens. What's needed is the kind of connection that seems to be missing in Courtney's case.
Anytime that you have a body drop, nothing is going to be more important than that eyewitness account or someone who saw something or heard something.
And for people to want to talk to you, that requires a certain level of trust between the community and the department.
Number one, you got to have trust.
10 months after Courtney's murder, a Department of Justice investigation concluded community trust in the Chicago Police Department was broken and urged police to fix it, saying, increasing community trust and confidence in CPD is necessary for CPD to be able to clear more homicides. The CPD's motto is, we serve and protect. A year after Courtney's murder, Shapiro saw a department that hadn't protected Courtney or served her. She went to meet with the CPD again, and once again she was recording. By this time, her relationship with detectives had deteriorated, and she challenged them on their record.
Y'all only have a 26% murder solve rate in the city of Chicago.
You know, people can talk about the police department as far as that goes, but it's the community that's failing here.
The sergeant said his detectives had been working Courtney's case hard.
Somebody knows what happened here, and they're not coming forward. I mean, we get spit on, we get kicked at, we get punched. You know, people refer to us as pigs. You know, all this sort of And you know, we're looking for help from the community to help your son, who's a good kid, and nobody will want to come forward.
To Shapiro, that now sounds like an excuse. What about the potential witnesses who'd called 911 that night? And Courtney's girlfriend, Alma, recently told us detectives still haven't spoken with her.
They did the bare minimum. The bare minimum is what Chicago Police Department did in my son's case.
The Chicago Police Department declined to discuss Courtney's murder, saying it's still an open case. An internal affairs investigation of how police treated Courtney at the scene concluded officers had done nothing wrong. In an email, the department said all cases are investigated thoroughly, which is pretty much what they said to Shapiro in that first meeting with detectives. The CPD also said their murder clearance rates are improving, but did not address the racial disparity we asked about. They did tell us about a reorganization involving new homicide teams supported by gang units and better technology. And they pointed to an investment in neighborhood policing that Chicago's current police superintendent David Brown announced earlier this month.
Arguably, this will be the most significant commitment of effort, resources, and leadership to building trust in Chicago PD's history.
At the same time, Chicago's Inspector General is looking at Courtney's case, everything from why he was handcuffed to how detectives investigated his murder. Shapiro continues to look for answers her way.
My name is Shapiro Wells. I'm Courtney Copeland's mom.
You were already listening to True Crime Podcast before this.
Yes, yes.
And then suddenly you became a True Crime Podcast.
Yes.
Shapiro now hosts a podcast about her son's case called Somebody, produced by Topic Studios, The Intercept, and The Invisible Institute. She wants to tell the story of what happened and what did not.
I'm going to take you with me, step by step, in my investigation.
The podcast was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. But Shapiro's not sure the people she really wants to hear her are listening.
I have no faith in Chicago Police Department that they will solve my son's murder.
So your mission's not over?
No. I will keep fighting for Courtney until my last breath, until they bring me a convicted murderer.
You know that won't even the scales.
No, but I feel that my son deserves justice.
That's all for now. I'm Lester Holt. Thanks for joining us.